I'm Leonard Lope. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Charlie Hayden is one of the greatest bassists in the history of jazz. That's not just my opinion, but pretty much everyone's. He was instrumental in creating free jazz in the late 1950s with the Ornette Coleman Quartet. And since the late 1960s, his Liberation Music Orchestra has been using jazz as a means of social and political expression. In 2002, he teamed up with the Cuban-born pianist Gonzalo Rubalcaba for the Grammy Award-winning album Nocturne, and on his latest album, The Land of the Sun, he has collaborated once again with Mr. Rubalcaba to explore some of the lesser-known sides of Mexican music, and I'm very pleased to welcome Charlie Hayden to my show today. Hi.
Hi.
Sometimes when you're performing, you seem to be so transported by the music that you begin to dance with that huge string bass that you play. Most bass players seem to just stick it into the ground and lean on it. But what's happening there? Are you even aware of the way you're moving when you're playing?
No, I'm not aware, and sometimes it gets me into trouble because I just had to go to the back doctor again yesterday because I don't really think about how I look or how I hold the instrument. I just play, and with my head down, my eyes closed, and several years ago, I had to have back surgery because not only the way I was standing, but also lifting the bass for 40 years, you know. So all bass players, beware, be careful.
It's not a guitar.
It's not a guitar, and no, but, you know, the most important thing in the process of improvising is not to think. The thought process stops, and everything becomes your ears and your heart.
Mm-hmm. And so you get so into the music, you're just transported.
Right.
Well, do you think it's partly because you began as a singer that you have that connection to the music?
I began as a singer with my parents who were on the Grand Ole Opry before I was born, and I was raised around Mother Maybelle Carter and the Delmore Brothers and Roy Acuff, and that was one of the greatest things that could ever have happened to me because I had an early musical background that was really splendid.
It's rumored that you actually did your first performance when you were 22 months old.
Right.
That's true?
That's true.
Not even 2 years old.
My mother was rocking me to sleep one day and singing, humming folk songs, and all of a sudden I started humming the harmony. And she said, Charlie, you're ready for the show.
You were a real sensation until physical problems changed all of that.
Well, I stopped singing at 15 because I had bulbar polio. That's back when, before the vaccine and the epidemic was really bad, and most people were in iron lungs and leg braces, but this hit the nerve to my face and my vocal cords, so I couldn't sing for about a year, but eventually everything went away. And I don't really have any range in my voice anymore, except I did sing. Shirley Horn talked me into singing on one of my last records with Quartet West called The Art of the Song. I sang Wayfaring Stranger.
I thought it was Terry Gross who got you into that.
She was the first person. She asked me to sing on her show, Now Is the Hour. And I said, you know, I don't really sing anymore. She said, come on. So I did, and after the show, she said, you know, you got to sing on one of your records.
Well, we tend to think of country music as being, at least traditional country music, as being rather simplistic in terms of the harmonies. And yet when you think of the Leuven Brothers, for example, and the kinds of things they did, it was difficult. I'm trying to sing along. Do you think that affected the way, because when you do bass lines, you're really thinking as a counter-harmonic voice, aren't you?
Counter, that's very observant of you. That's exactly the way I'm thinking. The harmony, for instance, I don't know if you've ever heard the Delmore Brothers. They were revolutionary in the way they did their harmonizing. And that was a big part of my early childhood, was singing every harmony part by ear, being able to do it by ear, you know. And, you know, somebody asked me a question, who influenced you on the bass? And I say Bach, because I used to listen to Bach's bass lines that he composed for all of his compositions. He had these great bass lines. And my brother, who was 5 years older than me, played bass on our radio show. And when he didn't play, everything fell apart for me. I mean, there was no more fullness. There was no more majesty. And when that bass started there, when I could hear the bass, that's when I loved it.
And many people don't notice that there's no bass until there's no bass. They don't hear the bass when they're listening to a group play, and then when the bass isn't, when there's no bass there, there's something missing there.
Exactly.
But are you improvising off of the melody and the harmony instead of the chord progressions as most bass players in jazz have over the years?
Most of the time I'm improvising on the chord progressions. You know, when I first got to Los Angeles in 1956 and I was looking for Hampton Hawes, my hero.
A great piano player.
Yeah, and going to a lot of jam sessions, I started hearing another way of improvising, which was not on the chord structure, but on the inspiration of the song. But whenever I tried to do that, the other musicians wouldn't know where I was, so I'd have to play the melody so they would know where to come back in. But when I met Ornette Coleman, that's the way he was playing.
You know? He was a kindred spirit, so...
He was a kindred spirit.
But how did you even wind up listening to Bach and then playing jazz if you came out of country music? There are real firewalls between all of those, or have been over the years.
That was a time when there was no television in the 40s, in the late 40s, and I was listening to a lot of radio. I listened to radio all the time, all different kinds of music, and there was this one classical show that I got, and I listened to classical music for hours, you know, and I loved Bach, and I loved Ravel, and I loved Prokofiev, and I loved Rachmaninoff. Rachmaninoff was my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Do we see that reflected in the way you play? Because people have described your bass sound as having a warm timbre that is more classical than jazz.
Well, you know, because I was in country music, it's really an acoustic music. I mean, the old country music. And
not today, where it's really Tin Pan Alley.
It's like
with
pop.
With a steel guitar.
The country music now is like pop music. It's very sad what's happened to it. But, you know, with the emergence of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And you know, Union Station, the guys in Union Station and Alison Krauss, they did Man of Constant Sorrow, which we used to sing on our radio show in the 40s, you know, with that great harmony. Mm-hmm. But the acoustic sound of that music lended itself to the wood sound of the instruments, you know, which is the bass and the fiddle. And the mandolin and the banjo, and the electronic sound hadn't even been thought about yet, you know. So I always hear the wood of the instrument. I always try to play the rainforest.
If you pick up somebody else's bass, do you still get your sound?
I believe, you know, unless it's just like a really horrible instrument.
It's interesting that two bass players or two pianists can play on the same piano. And, you know, Bud Powell played on a piano and then Art Tatum played on the piano. You'd know after two notes who was playing.
That's the miracle of this art form. And I tell my students at California Institute of the Arts, where I founded the jazz studies 22 years ago, I tell them that this class is about discovering their sounds. Like, everyone has different fingerprints when you're born. Everyone hears music differently. And it's amazing how a metal machine like a saxophone, you know, someone like Coleman Hawkins can play it and sound exactly like he hears. And he can pick up another instrument and sound exactly the same. And that's a miracle.
You also tell your students that they have to be great humans before they can be great musicians. But haven't there been some pretty creepy giants in music over the years?
Was there an album called Creepy Giants?
Creepy Giant Steps.
You know,
well, Coltrane was one of those great humans.
Oh,
actually.
Man, Coltrane was one of those great humans. I had a chance to record with him. He used to be in the Five Spot every night, 1959, we were talking about before, listening to us every night. But, you know, it's difficult when you start thinking about personalities and human beings connected to the creative process. But I really believe if a person strives to become a good human being with qualities of appreciativeness and humility in their lives, they will become a great musician.
Well, you also have looked for beautiful music. There have been musicians over the years who've stressed the uglier side of music. But even though you have been involved in free-form avant-garde jazz, you've always somehow found the most beautiful sides of those things.
Because of growing up in country music and melodies and harmonies.
So how did you wind up with Mr. Rubalcaba? He is a Cuban pianist, and now you're making a Mexican record. And you grew up in the Ozarks.
Right.
Neither of you could have had all that much experience with Mexican music.
Well, Gonzalo did when he was growing up. In all the Latin American music came through Cuba.
Mm. There's a Caribbean sensibility, you think?
Yes. And I met him in 1986. I was invited to go to the jazz festival in Havana, Cuba, to perform with my Liberation Music Orchestra. And my wife Ruth and I got everybody together, and we went down to Havana. And it was much easier back then. And we played, and after we performed, there was a group that came on stage called Proyecto. And when the piano started soloing, I said, "What's that?" You know, I looked at Ruth, and I said, and so we asked to go backstage to meet him. And he was 23 years old, Gonzalo was, and he didn't speak English, and there was a translator and interpreter, and he told me he was a big fan from all my music with Keith Jarrett and Ornette, different people. And we went right over to Egram Studios the next day, and we played all day long. And I started looking for ways when I got back to the States to bring him to the States, and because of the embargo, it was impossible. And so I got him into Canada. The year that they did a tribute to me, I played with 8 different people for a week. And
The
Montreal Jazz Festival. And I got Gonzalo on one of the concerts. And then I produced his first trio record and made different records with his groups. And we became very, very close friends. Our families are very close. And when we did Nocturne, it was something very, very special for me because Gonzalo introduced me to the boleros that I didn't know about. And the boleros are those love songs that come from Latin America that most of the people in this country don't ever hear because they're exposed to the up-tempo things and they don't hear the beautiful ballads.
But jazz musicians have tended to stick to the American songbook and jazz standards, mostly 4/4. And you've always looked to other sources. You played Hanns Eisler
yes.
music with your and found a jazz way of performing that. Cuban music has always had some kind of a jazz side to it. But Mexican music, did you have to adjust it a lot to be able to improvise on it?
Well, I have to adjust a lot music from different countries because I play the way I play, and I play from what I hear and what inspires me. So, I wasn't born in Cuba, I wasn't born in Mexico, I was born in Missouri, but I love all different kinds of music, and to me, there's really no categories when I think about art forms, and I just think about beautiful music, and that's why I play with so many different people. And I like to bring the music, different kinds of music, to different kinds of listeners, because I feel that jazz right now has some kind of like a, it's limiting itself right now.
But it does have a history of being a politically concerned music, and not just Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit and some of the other things we think of in the past, but it's always had a very strong consciousness. It integrated fairly early in its history at a time when pretty much everything else was segregated in this country. So I suspect that has also played a part in the way you approach it.
It has. It's a political process and a struggle to get the music to people. From the get-go, it's always been, and because jazz is a minority art form, and beauty right now, we need more beauty in the world, and we need more beauty in our lives, and that's what, you know, I'm dedicated to, and I tell everybody when they come to hear us play, I wish I could multiply you guys thousands and thousands of times so there would be more people like you in the world, because we need more and more people to appreciate beauty. So I try to attract all different kinds of listeners to expose them to music that they wouldn't ordinarily be exposed to. But it is a political art form. In a natural way, jazz is.
The album we've been talking about is Land of the Sun with Gonzalo Rubalcaba. Are you performing in town as well?
Yes. We opened at the Village Vanguard last night. We'll be there with the album, the music of the album Land of the Sun through Sunday.
With Gonzalo? Or?
With Gonzalo.
Oh, how exciting.
And last night, the tenor player was David Sanchez. Tonight is going to be Joe Lovano.
Wow.
And Miguel Zinon is playing alto, and Michael Rodriguez is playing trumpet, and Oriente Lopez is playing flute, and Antonio Sanchez is playing drums. And it's, I mean, they're amazing, amazing musicians.
You seem to like to play with different musicians all the time. Some people like to play with the same group, but I guess it's always an exploration for you.
It's an exploration for inspiration.
Charlie Hayden's latest album, Land of the Sun, with Gonzalo Rubalcaba. And then there are the performances at the Village Vanguard. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. And, you know, Monday night is a special.
I'm Leonard Lopeta, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. We're listening to Gonzalo Rubalcaba and Charlie Hayden playing a song that we don't normally think of as Mexican, You Belong to My Heart, but it is actually Solamente Una Vez, a Mexican song. It's one of the songs featured on a new album by Charlie Hayden and Gonzalo Rubalcaba on Verve called Land of the Sun. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820 online at WNYC.org. When you're playing under those circumstances, just you and a piano player, it's kind of naked, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it different than when you have a whole group and perhaps if you hit a wrong note or if you just don't think about what you're playing as well as you should, that it doesn't matter, it just gets lost?
It's a little less naked when you have a great drummer like Ignacio Baroa,
mm-hmm.
and what we have at have at the Vanguard, Antonio Sanchez.
But he was just playing wide brushes.
He was playing light brushes, which is very appropriate for Solamente Una Vez, but the duets are when it's really naked. Like, I love duets. I've been doing duets since my first record, duets called Closeness. I did duets with Keith Jarrett and Alice Coltrane playing the harp and Ornette, and that was on Horizon A&M. And ever since then, I've done a lot of duets, and I guess the most famous one being with Hank Jones, an album called Steal Away, where we play all spirituals and hymns and folk songs, and a duet with Kenny Barron, a duet with Carlos Paredes, the fado player from Portugal, many. And you know, I don't think of it so much as being naked. I just think of it as being able to listen, really deeply listen to the other musician and hear the timbre of their instrument and hear, you know, their thoughts, hear their thoughts.
But you also suffer from a sensitivity to loud noise. So I would think that playing in this context with a piano player and a drummer on brushes rather than playing loudly on his snare might actually be something that you'd appreciate.
It is. Whenever I play in a jazz club, especially a small jazz club, I usually play duets.
Or what I've seen you do, I remember when I saw you with Keith Jarrett with a larger group, you had what looked like headphones that you put on, I guess to protect yourself against the loud noises. You were standing right in front of the drummer.
Yes, sometimes I did that. Other times I wore earplugs when I had to stand in front of the drums. You know, there are certain people that have genetic a thing happening with ears. And then other people get it from, you know, you can hear a gunshot and get ringing in the ears. I don't know if you've ever been to a loud concert and your ears were ringing after the concert.
For a day sometimes.
Yeah.
You feel like you just have, your ears are in a little bit of a fog.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a condition called tinnitus and another condition called hyperacusis. And the tinnitus is ringing in the ears and the hyperacusis is... it's like the volume is turned up in your head. You hear too much. Every time I take a hearing test, I go over the thing. And loud noise is really painful to me. And
so that must make it really rough for you sometimes, especially when you have your band, when you have the orchestra, and they're going to play loud sometimes.
Yeah, everybody takes my conditions into account, and everybody, you know, goes easy on me and plays soft. But sometimes I actually, it's become really common now in symphony orchestras and in rock bands. You see more and more plexiglass on the stage surrounding the drummers, and that's become a very normal thing. I used to use, with my Quartet West, I guess I was one of the first jazz bands to have it. And a funny little story, you know, Joe Henderson was a very, very close friend. And a great musician.
Tenor player.
And he had these one-liners that were just precious, you know, he would say. And I saw him at a concert in Germany once in the dressing room. He was playing opposite us, and I hugged him, and he said, Charlie, he says, what's that glass, man? What's that glass? I said, well, that's for my... And before I could tell him what it's for, he said, that's the hippest-looking stuff, man, I've ever seen. He said, you always have the hippest stuff. He said, I got to get some of that.
Well, you're not alone, and I'm sure just in standing in the middle of that noise, as you said, rock musicians, of them talk about having serious hearing problems, and I assume that half the guys I stand next to in the subway who have headphones on, but I can still hear what they're listening to, are going to have problems down the line as well.
Headphones cause the same problem. A lot of musicians have lost the highs in their hearing, and they don't even realize it. And some of them do realize it, and it's a terrible thing. But I've come to adjust to it over the years, and it's just a part of my life, the ringing in my ears. If I stopped to think about it, I'd probably go crazy, but it's no big deal anymore, and I just, you know, try to protect my ears. I wear earplugs that knock out 32 dBs when I have to wear them. You know.
You have played a wide range of jazz, from the sort of thing that most people consider traditional jazz to the freest form jazz. Is it hard to make the adjustment, or is playing music playing music? Does it matter whether you're playing with let's say, Coleman Hawkins or Hank Jones or Ornette Coleman?
Playing good music is playing good music, you know. I mean, I just played on Ringo Starr's last record called Ringo Rama. And he's a great drummer and a great guy, and I just played behind Robert Downey Jr., who's got a new record coming out of him singing this song called Smile, written by Charlie Chaplin, which he starred in that movie. You know, and I play
with your heart Bruce, is breaking.
Yeah, Bruce Hornsby, Ricky Lee Jones, Beck. You know, my kids are all musicians, and they introduced me to all the great bands. And I play with a lot of, I've made classical music with Gavin Bryars and the English Chamber Symphony. And I really believe in playing different kinds of music and playing with different kinds of musicians from different places. That's the way I learn, and that's the way I grow as a human being and as a musician, to find out as much as I can about people who have the same values about life that I do and the same values about music that I do.
When you were playing free jazz, you said that the idea was to play music as if you've never heard music before and you're creating something that's never been created before.
Yes.
That sounds like a rough assignment.
That's the way I think about it. I think about it as if I've never ever heard music before and that I'm playing it for the first time. That way there won't be any chance of having any preconceived notion of what you're going to do.
Now, you've been with Verve for quite a while now, Verve, which is one of the great jazz labels. Nowadays, we see musicians jump over from label to label, and because jazz has suffered in this country, many times they record for Japanese labels. How have you been able to stay with one major label for so long?
Because I've developed a great relationship with the people at Verve here in New York and Verve in France, Universal. They all love the music, and they're dedicated to the music, and they love my music, which is very important to me and to them, and I think Verve is the greatest label in the world.
You actually have done a lot of stuff for the French Verve, including film noir.
Yes.
Albums?
My Quartet West, which started back in 1986 was the first record, and 87. And then the third record that came out was the one that was made the impact. It was called Haunted Heart, and it was about film noir period in Hollywood. When I got to L.A., it was 1956, right at the end of the film noir period, you know, and it was a very fascinating period of time to me because I love the movies. I love John Garfield and Lauren Bacall and Claire Trevor and all those people. And I love the movie composers, Franz Waxman and Max Steiner, and all those guys were such great composers.
Because you like the big romantic music.
Oh, yeah. And these guys were the great composers of the films, you know.
Just one more thing, because
yeah.
I wanted to get to this before we go out. Maybe we can hear a little bit of the Liberation Orchestra. You're working here with Gonzalo Rubalcaba at the Village Vanguard through Sunday. And then on Monday you're coming back with the Liberation Music Orchestra, and that is a pre-election day performance?
Yeah, Ruth and I are very concerned about the election, and we really wanted to get out the vote, and so I said let's do a special concert Monday night before the election with my Liberation Music Orchestra and Carl Bley. We just did a new record in Rome, and that's what we're going
to
do.
And we'll listen to a little bit of it as we go out. My great thanks to you, Charlie Hayden.
Thanks,
Leonard. It's been such a pleasure to meet you.
You're a great guy. Thank you.